now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Hey! Nice going. Today we're going to take a look at the Veterans Health Care Administration and the moves by right-wingers to create a crisis leading to privatization. They've already started with the CHOICE program, and we'll hear about that in some detail with author Suzanne Gordon. Her new book is The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. And in addition to Suzanne Gordon, you'll hear three veterans talk about their own experiences at the Veterans Healthcare Administration. This podcast is made possible by people like you who take out subscriptions and send me a few bucks every month, like Cheryl Fleming, Susan Gavet, Carl Howard, and Tim McKay. They each kick in $5 a month. Can you do it? Well, if the answer is yes, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page, and from there, you've got options. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, we're going to talk about the efforts to privatize the Veterans Healthcare Administration. Suzanne Gordon has been writing about medical issues for years, and her new book is The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. Suzanne, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Now, you've been writing about health and medical issues for quite a while. Do you have service in your own background? Were you in the military?
No, I wasn't in the military, and I am not a nurse or a doctor. I've been writing about healthcare and healthcare systems for over 30 years.
Yeah.
I edit a book series for Cornell University Press on the culture and politics of healthcare work, and I've written 19 books myself, and
wow.
I think this one is the 19th, and most of them are about healthcare mm-hmm. in one form or another.
And what drew you to focus on the VA? And you've done a lot of personal research on this.
I have spent almost 4 years hanging around with veterans and talking to veterans and visiting different VAs, Veterans Health Administration facilities around the country. There's 1,700 of them, so it's kind of hard to visit every one
yeah.
of them, and they're in every state, and even in Manila, so in Guam. So I've visited maybe 30,
mm-hmm.
but I've spent a lot of time at San Francisco's Fort Miley and in Martinez,
mm-hmm.
but I've been in Boston and New Haven and San Antonio and on and on.
Now, Suzanne, I read the papers and watch TV, and I know at every Veterans Administration facility, there are long lines. There are patients who can't get in. They wait 6 months to a year to get their paperwork completed. Does that jibe with your experience?
No, it doesn't. And we now have a media narrative that's been promoted by the right wing conservative funders, the Koch brothers, who are determined to finance a narrative that the government can never do anything right. And they
mm-hmm.
picked on the VA as their poster child. And the VA does have wait time problems. The VA does have problems, absolutely. But those problems are really congressionally created by failures to fund and staff the VA.
And Suzanne, as I read your book, these are not perfect parallels, but it reminded me of the way Congress is trying to kill the post office. by requiring the post office to prepay its health and pension benefits in a bizarre bookkeeping scheme that makes it look like the post office loses money every year, and FedEx and UPS are chomping at the bit. They're paying off members of Congress trying to get them to privatize the delivery of the post. And I see similar efforts at the VA.
Well, and I think the most apt parallel is with the public schools and the defunding of the public schools, the blaming of teachers for social problems like poverty. I mean, veterans are, first of all, we really have to understand that the VA is actually three different agencies. And a lot of the wait times are at the Veterans Benefit Administration. And they have to decide whether you are worthy of or eligible for VA benefits like the GI Bill and health care and so forth.
And isn't one of the barriers there that the Pentagon's computer system is incompatible with the Veterans Benefits Administration computers?
Well, that is one barrier. And the other barrier, really the biggest barrier, is the eligibility requirements that Congress has imposed, which say that not every veteran, not every one of the 21 to 22 million veterans are eligible for VA health care, but only those who have a service-connected disability and or low income. So you have to stop by the Veterans Benefit Administration first and assemble a big dossier to prove that you in fact got that bad knee or asthma or whatever in your service. And that means that you have to have a paper trail when you served. And a lot of veterans, a lot of military service members do not know that they have to go to the medic when they have a cough or an injury. And in fact, they're discouraged from going to the medic or to the doctor, particularly if it's a mental health issue. So there isn't a paper trail for many people. And then there are disputes about, you know, burn pit exposures, Gulf War syndrome. There was a terrible dispute about Agent Orange. So the VBA, you have to ask veterans when they say, I have to wait. You have to ask them where they have to wait. And the Veterans Benefit Administration has been chronically underfunded and understaffed. And again, that's down to Congress. The eligibility requirements are down to Congress. The waits, and even the waits at the VA, are down to funding because there's 49,000 positions vacant in the largest healthcare system in the United States. Everywhere I go, PT was just cut. They aren't hiring psychologists because they do not have the budget.
Mm-hmm. Now, I interrupted you. You were starting to define. We have the cabinet-level agency, which is the Department of Veterans Affairs, right? Then there's the Veterans Benefits Administration, and then there's the VHA, the Veterans Health Care Administration.
Veterans Health Administration.
Okay, and they operate the medical facilities.
They operate the largest fully integrated, publicly funded healthcare system in the entire United States and one of the largest in the world.
Well, we better shut it down. That sounds like socialism to me.
Right. And you know what it is?
You mean
it's
government,
social.
The government manages it from end to end. They pay for it and everything?
They pay for it and everything, and they manage it. And you know what? They have some real managerial problems, which we have to solve. But every study has shown, and there have been many, many of them. There was just another one out last week, that the VA delivers care that is superior to, equal or superior to that in the private sector, and that way exceeds care in the private sector in areas like diabetes management, mental health care. This study last week was about the dangers of veterans going into the private sector for pain management because they are prescribed more opioids and so forth. So we have just study after study, and the Congress is just simply ignoring these studies which is kind of one of the, you know, one of the, I made a checklist for privatization, you know, what you have to do to privatize a system. And one of the things you do is you say that it's broken. And the other thing you do, among the 10 points that I have, is ignore the evidence that it's actually very well functioning.
You provided me with your handy checklist here. Portray private health care as the solution to inequality or service problems in the VA. Ignore the good quality of care that is occurring. And so, Suzanne, you know, when we look at privatization, we always have to ask, well, who's going to benefit? who will extract profits from a system that currently doesn't, carry the burden of having to produce a profit. So who are the likely suspects here?
Well, the likely suspects, the VA has a $65, $70 billion plus budget, and the Veterans Health Administration. And the people who will profit are private sector doctors, healthcare systems, medical equipment companies, pharmaceutical companies, because the VA negotiates with pharmaceutical companies for better drug prices. Mm-hmm. The VA doctors and nurses and professionals are not on salaries, so they have no incentive to overtreat. And private sector doctors, of course, on fee-for-service have a huge incentive. And VHA healthcare is much more cost effective. In fact, they've done studies that show that the costs, if you were to transfer just 60% of eligible veterans to the private sector, would quadruple. It could be as much as $450 billion. Mm. I mean, so there are a lot of people out there with their hands, open and grabbing and wanting some of this moolah,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and the pharmaceutical industry just by itself showers so much campaign money in Washington. They have incredible leverage, and they've managed to maintain the elements of Obamacare that forbid the kind of negotiation that the VA does for
Absolutely.
Prescription
and,
drugs.
And hospital chains, there was a VA Commission on Care that I write a lot about in Battle for Veterans Healthcare that was mandated by Congress to look at the future of the VA. And three of the people on it, aside from two who kind of represented the Koch brothers' position, were hospital executives. One of them was Toby Cosgrove, who is the CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, makes $5 million a year and plus perks. And he wants to totally privatize the VA, and he is now one of the people that Trump has assembled to advise Secretary David Shulkin. And we now have, who is now Secretary of the VA, we now have several members of the Koch brothers, Concerned Veterans for America, which is a veteran service group that is not a service group and has no veteran members. It parades as a veteran service group, and it has been allowed into policymaking circles in the Trump administration that usually would be unprecedented in any other administration.
Well, and Trump and his cronies have signaled that they'll sell anything, lease it. They're making deals with the Saudis to help fund infrastructure improvements in the United States, and it's unclear what the Saudis would own after a project like that is completed. And this is quite insidious, to take the commons and lease them or sell them off to private concerns, many of whom are cronies or at least pals of Trump.
Well, there's a lot of groups that are fighting this, and these groups, the veteran service organizations like the Disabled American Veterans and the Vietnam Veterans America, AMVETS, and a group called Fighting for Veterans Healthcare, which is a local San Francisco-based group, have really fought valiantly against proposals coming out of Congress that would essentially, in the name of choice and to extend this choice program that was started in 2014 to help with wait time problems and veterans who have to wait more than 30 days or drive more than 40 miles are able to go to a private sector doctor. But there are all these problems with choice. It's much more expensive. It's running out of money. And really, the solution is to give more money to the VA mm-hmm. and not to the private sector. Last week, they passed a legislation that would give the VA $2 billion to choice and $1.4 billion to the VA. But we should be giving more money to the VA than to the private sector. Now, this is a victory of sorts, but we are going to be fighting this battle around so-called choice, which is very appealing to many people. Oh, my God, you have a choice and the government is holding you hostage. But the reality is that veterans have always been able to get private sector health care for things that the VA doesn't provide. And the solution to the problems of wait times and service capacity is to give more money to the VA and expand the VA. Senators Patty Miller have and John Tester favor that. Bernie Sanders has just introduced legislation to give $5 billion more to the VA to fund these vacancies. And that's what we should be calling our congresspeople about, not giving money to this phony choice. You know, not every choice is a good choice.
Well, and these people are only pro-choice when it's convenient.
Yeah, exactly.
We've lined up a couple of people to join us on the program today. And first, Diane Rapoon in San Francisco. Diane, thanks for joining us today. What can you tell us on the front lines of the pressures to privatize the VA?
Well, I am also a veteran who gets my health care at the VA. And I have to say that when it comes to this choice program, that it's frankly just crazy that they think that this is what veterans need, because I just recently was referred to Stanford from the Palo Alto VA, which happened before in the past when the VA didn't have something, especially for female care, that they didn't have. They would make a phone call, they would schedule an appointment for me, and I was at Stanford within a couple of weeks. Now we have to go through this complicated choice program where I get a phone call from TriWest, which is a healthcare provider or insurance provider that is making big money from the VA, and from the things that I've heard, these are jobs that are trying to be protected by the Republicans in Congress, and I have to tell them what days I want an appointment for or when I might be available, and then they will contact Stanford, and maybe Stanford will call me, and maybe I'll get a letter, which happened the last time, basically telling me I had an appointment in a week at a place I didn't even know about and that I didn't want to go to and at an inconvenient time. Mm-hmm. So choice is not a good answer. What would be better would be for, you know, more services to be available at the VA. Or if they aren't available at the VA, then back to the original process they had, which was simply to sort of contract out with other people and then pay the bills. But they've created this crazy system. So for me, as a veteran, I'm very against this whole choice thing and expanding it and making it more complicated and taking things away from us that we could have gotten previously at the VA, like physical therapy, and making me go out and make appointments and travel different places. It's just doesn't seem to be very, you know, good for the veterans, but that's not what they're looking at.
Diane, do you see this choice program as an element of the effort to privatize by draining, you know, critical financial resources from the general operations of the VHA, as I referenced, like the post office, where you create a situation that you then have to fix? Is that what you
absolutely
see going on?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because essentially they said, okay, we have this choice program, and now, oh, the choice program isn't working very well, so let's put more money into that, when the choice program was originally created so that we could just catch up
right
with those wait times. But instead, now it's become an entitlement that, okay, everybody now needs to get choice, and they just keep pumping more money into it. And it's taking money away from the VA. As an employee, I see that every day. I mean, I have no supervisor in the position that I'm supposed to have a supervisor in. I am missing two employees who are supposed to be working for me. And the answer is you can only hire from people within the San Francisco VA. So in other words, I have to go cannibalize from somebody else's department if I'm going to get those people into our department.
Hmm. And let me ask you about this. What impact has the wave of veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan had on the ability to deliver services? We hear about the, you know, long wait times for accessing benefits, but has this new wave of veterans created a stressful patient load at the VA?
I don't think so, really. I mean, I am one of those. I went to Iraq in 2009, and I came back in 2010, and I had my physical from the Veterans Benefits Benefits Administration, because I did happen to have all of my records. You know, in the later years, things were much more electronically maintained. So I got in, I got my appointment. Within 3 months, I had my rating, disability rating, and I had my first appointment with my primary care provider. And I see, you know, Iraq war veterans coming through all the time. I think they're actually the easiest ones to handle, and that they have not been the ones that created this wait time. The biggest problem is the fact that things like Agent Orange, for years and years, they denied that that was an issue, and now there are literally, you know, hundreds and probably thousands of veterans who didn't realize that they were eligible for benefits, and now they're going through that whole benefits process. So as an Iraq war veteran, I did not experience any problem getting into the VA and being seen. I have never been asked to wait more than probably 2 weeks for an appointment. And in one situation, I literally went to the ER on a Sunday, and Tuesday night I was getting an MRI.
So, yeah, and I think that it's really important to ask a question that very few people ask when they talk about wait times in the Veterans Health Administration, which is compared to what? Because private sector wait times are worse than wait times in the VA, which are actually quite reasonable often. And also, you have to ask the question, where are the wait times? In other words, in rural areas, there are wait times in the private sector. I mean, Merritt Hawkins just did a study. They're the company that does the studies of wait times in the U.S., and they showed that private sector wait times are up 30% between 2014, when this VA wait time problem surfaced. And in the private sector, they are up 30%. In Boston, you can wait 109 days for a family practice appointment. The average wait now in the VA is like 4 or 5 days. And they've done a lot to remedy them, these wait time problems. And, for example, in the private sector, mental health wait times are terrible. You can't find mental health providers that will accept insurance for some of the standard evidence-based practices that treat veterans with PTSD or depression or so forth. And I recently in the Bay Area tried to find a primary care physician, because my primary care physician went out of practice, and all the practices I went to were closed. Hmm. So, you know.
Well, and I shared with you before we went on the air, Suzanne, that with Obamacare, it actually created a two-tier system. And I was in the second-class position, couldn't access the doctors in-network, and couldn't find, you know, basic services like a dermatologist within 50 miles of my home.
Right.
So, I mean, there are it really sounds like the VHA, and we're not blue-skying here and saying that, you know, every patient gets everything they need at the moment they need it. But it seems that overall, it's a pretty efficient system. Diane, I want to ask you about one other thing that Suzanne referenced in passing earlier, mm-hmm. and that is the new wave of veterans who report respiratory and other issues related to the burn pits. And I've interviewed Joseph Hickman, who wrote the book about the burn pits, which is quite revealing. And, mm-hmm. and I'll just say that he speculates that Joe Biden's son, Beau, died of that virulent cancer that he did as a result of exposure to burn pits in Iraq. And we've seen that just recently a court threw out the case against KBR, the contractor mm-hmm. who ran the burn pits, saying that, well, they were just following military orders and the military is immune. But in terms of healthcare for these veterans, are there ways to treat them where they don't have to be tagged as burn pit victims, because that's not an acknowledged issue? It's kind of like Agent Orange was for many years before the VA said, okay, yes, we do have a problem, we'll address it.
Well, you know what is very interesting is that I was actually in Iraq at the same time as Joe Biden's son. Mm. And we were both stationed at Camp Victory. And I left Iraq with asthma. chronic asthma. And they said, oh, it'll go away in a couple of months after you get back to the States. Never has. And that is part of my 30% disability. So the idea that, you know, at that time, even though theoretically they weren't still doing, you know, a lot of the open burn pits, there was still a huge amount of, you know, problems with the air, and there was a battery fire, and there was, you know, all kinds of issues that I wouldn't at all be surprised that that was, you know, some sort of cause to, you know, anybody that was there in Iraq at the whole time. In terms of specifically, you know, how do people get treated for it if it wasn't, you know, necessarily burn pits isn't being recognized. I mean, I think it's the symptoms in my case that they recognized. So I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not sure how that works with if it's a burn pit. Although I also have an employee who I hired, who is a veteran, who actually has migraines whenever he gets near anything that smells like smoke, and he was directly affected by burn pits. And he, luckily, he is in the VA. He is getting his health care in the VA, and he's just recently been referred to a neurologist to try and deal with, you know, why he gets these headaches when he literally cannot walk past the smoking section of, you know, the outdoor area without being affected.
And one more question along those lines. We do now accept Gulf War Syndrome as a category of causes, right?
I believe so, yes. And I'm not in that area of the VA, so I wouldn't be able to be the definitive answer on that.
Do you know, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think that there's all kinds of things that are now recognized. We recognize military sexual trauma. I mean, the problem is it takes a lot of time to recognize and document these things. And one of the big problems with privatization and choice is that if you have veterans scattered around the private sector, they're not going to be collecting the kind of information that the VA collects about veterans that can eventually begin to legitimize and diagnose these problems. I mean, PTSD, the fact that the VA finally recognized kicking and screaming PTSD happened not only because veterans fought for it, but because people, psychologists and so forth within the VA started recognizing patterns in the veterans that came to them around mental health. And now, thanks to people like Terry Keene in Boston and Matt Schnur and Matt Friedman and Joe Ruzick in Palo Alto and so forth, they have a national center for PTSD, and the VA is a leader. But you have to have a significant volume of veterans reporting significant problems for people to finally say, oh, wow, you know, that, gee, I saw that last week and now I'm seeing it this week and so forth. And you're not going to have that if there's one or two veterans in somebody's practice.
Diane, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add before you go?
No, I guess I think the one thing that I would like to add is that it just drives me crazy when every time I read an article about the VA, it starts with the scandal-ridden VA or the corrupt VA. And I really wish that our media and reporters would start actually reporting, you know, the real news and not just, and I would hesitate to say fake news, but you know, the news from 2014, when there was one scandal, which has also been totally overblown and reported falsely for many years, that people would, you know, start reporting what's really going on with the VA. But the trouble is that organizations like the one that I'm with, Fighting for Veterans Healthcare, we don't have the kind of money the Koch brothers have to literally barrage media with, you know, negative stories about the VA. And we're doing everything we can to get the positive stories out. So I appreciate that you're willing to tell our stories and to do something like this.
It's my pleasure, Diane. Thank you very much. Nice talking with you.
Thank you. You too.
Now let's go to Boston, and Samuel J. Kaiser joins us. He's retired from MIT. Can I call you doctor?
Oh, whatever whatever you like.
Okay, Dr. Kaiser, thanks for being with us today. Suzanne told me just a little bit about your experience, but would you share with our listeners that you had a spinal cord injury and you found out along the way that you qualified for care at the VHA, and it made a big difference?
Well, that's right. I guess the best way to describe me was that I was an accident waiting to happen. I had a condition that I had no idea I had. What it led to was a narrowing of my spinal column.
Mm-hmm.
While I was exercising at home one day, my right leg collapsed. I fell on my back, and in a nanosecond, I was transported into the world of tetraplegia. By that, I mean that I was completely paralyzed from my chest down. I had no use of my arms or my legs. I went to three hospitals. The first one was Massachusetts General Hospital, where they performed an operation that basically relieved the pressure. It was I was in the hands of some brilliant surgeons, neurosurgeons, and they did a fantastic job. Then I was sent to a rehabilitation hospital, and that's when I think I came up against the wall of healthcare in America. It turns out that at this rehabilitation hospital, the problem was they could only keep me until my Medicaid insurance gave out, and that was roughly 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That was 6 weeks. That was roughly 6 weeks. That's so-called length of stay problem. And I was somebody who needed not 6 weeks of care, but I needed something more like a year of care. But after 4 weeks, the attention of the hospital that I was in turned not from making me better, but from finding a place to send me, so because my insurance ran out. Well, I had the great good fortune of a case manager who noticed that I'd been in the Air Force. That hadn't occurred to me. I mean, I was in the Air Force from 63 to 1960, 62 to 1965, and then I went on to other things, and I just hadn't realized that I was eligible for VA care. But I guess the way I can put it is this. If that person hadn't noticed that I was eligible for catastrophic injury care with the VA, my life would be ruined. I would have just been completely ruined. I'd be in a nursing home now, lying in a bed where I couldn't move at all. But what essentially the VA did was they gave me back my life, because they were able to pay attention to my needs, not my pocketbook. Never once did the question of money arise.
All they were
concerned with.
This just underscores for me that the for-profit delivery of health care is a proven failure. And as you were describing your good fortune of getting long-term rehabilitation from the VHA, I'm thinking of how many people were sent to some subpar nursing home to vegetate and just wait until they expire.
It breaks your heart.
Because they couldn't afford or didn't have the right insurance to get the care that they needed. This is obscene.
I think I couldn't agree with you more. I think it is absolutely obscene. But it's essentially when your God is mammon, that is to say, when what you're concerned about is money and not people, this is what happens. I just saw it in black and white at my rehabilitation hospital that was a sort of a bottom line hospital. After 4 weeks, their primary concern was, we've got to get this guy out of here because his insurance is running out.
Yeah.
The fact that I needed to have some kind of rehabilitation didn't matter to them. But when I got to the VA, I was at a place not only where they paid no attention to money, but there was something else. The workers in the VA, the hospital, the nurses, the staff, and the therapists were all people who were on a mission. They'd seen me as somebody who had made a sacrifice for them, and now what they wanted to do was pay back. And I was just completely struck by that. The reason why the RAND Corporation, I think, did a recent study which showed that the medical care, I think the quote is that the quality of care delivered by VA is generally equal to or better than care delivered in the private sector. And part of the reason for that is that the people who deliver the care care.
And you got, my understanding is that that they told you when you left the rehab hospital, the private rehab hospital, you'd never walk again. And now you are walking, playing the trombone, traveling.
Let me sort of put a little bit of flesh on that. When I was in the MGH, the Massachusetts General Hospital, at first they didn't think I was going to live. And the reason was because I was 78 years old, and I had acquired a number of infections, and they thought, well, this guy is just not going to be able to withstand this. Well, for whatever reason, I did. And then a doctor came in and said, you know, your operation is a success, but you'll never walk again. And then they transferred me to a not-for-profit rehab rehabilitation hospital. And I thought not-for-profit meant that that money wouldn't play a role. I'll never forget this conversation I had with an orderly one night. They had to catheterize me. And the reason why they had to do that was that I'd lost control of all of my functions. I mean, I was literally like an infant. I know what it's like to be an infant when you're in pain and you need help and there's nothing you can do except cry. That's basically what I was, what it was like for me. And there was this one night when this guy was going to catheterize me in order to help me void. And there were two catheters. There was a straight catheter, which cost the hospital $1. It was a self-contained package, very efficient. And then there was a catheter that cost, I think, $12. And it was designed for somebody who had an enlarged prostate. Well, it turns out that the more expensive one was the one that I needed. And this man, before he catheterized me, he gave me a lecture on the cost of these two catheters. And he he showed me, can you imagine, he was saying, the cost it is to the hospital if we had to use this expensive catheter four times a day? For you, it would cost, you alone, it would cost $40. I think it was $10 a pop. And just to multiply that by the number of patients who... And I'm lying there thinking, why is he telling me this? Does he want me to go for the cheaper one? I don't even think he knew why he was telling me this. I think the point is that when you are in a hospital that has to pay attention to the bottom line, then money simply permeates you the way perfume does in a room. Hmm. You just can't you can't escape the odor of money. And I can tell you that at the VA hospital, money never... I can't remember one instance when anybody said anything about what I needed in terms of the cost. When I went into the VA hospital, the nursing staff was told that this was a man who probably would never walk again. Mm-hmm. Now walk a mile a day with the help of a walker. I had a musical life as a jazz trombone player. The VA, when I went down to the gym and I said, you know, I play trombone, would you mind incorporating that into my therapy? They didn't give me an argument. They were happy as clams. They said, oh, what a great idea. Where can we get a trombone?
Dr. Kaiser, what is your attitude toward privatization of the Veterans Healthcare Administration?
Here's what I think. I don't know what the VA budget is. It's, what, $68 billion?
Something like that.
What I see is these people who want to hurt the VA are like vultures who are circling around a pot of money. That's why they want to change it. They're saying that money could be ours. Instead, it's going into the care of these people. And that's my feeling. If it weren't for the VA, I wouldn't have a life.
Well, Dr. Kaiser, thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it, and that's quite a moving story. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good to talk with you. So, Suzanne, the way I view it, and I did not serve in the military, I'll just be candid about that, I believe that veterans have a contract, that part of the service contract when they joined the military was that you get low pay and long hours and a lot of travel to exotic locations, but you get, you know, adequate health care, particularly if you served in combat.
Well, and I think also that we have to recognize that part of the contract that you mention is that it's not just low pay and travel and so forth, but it's very dangerous work. And you're shooting guns, you're carrying packs that are 70, 100 pounds, that you have more muscular skeletal injuries, you know, shoulder, back, knee, feet, whatever. You're, even if you never leave the United States, you're subject to sadistic drills, sergeants on occasion. You are subject to all kinds of exposures, toxic exposures. You do not have to leave the U.S. to get to be subject mm-hmm. to toxic exposures. The number one reason why veterans go to the VA is because of hearing loss and tinnitus, because there's almost no branch of the military service that doesn't have some kind of toxic exposure. And if the VA puts out a guide to its providers, its doctors, nurses, et cetera, on taking a military health history, and it's unimaginable all the different exposures to which veterans are exposed. And so, yes, we owe it to people. We made a contract, and we owe it to them to provide them this excellent care. And the care that the American public, you know, I have a bumper. This group, Fighting for Veterans Healthcare, puts out a bumper sticker, "I love my VA," and there's another bumper sticker, "Save our VA." And I'm not a veteran, you know. I don't have any stake in this at all. It's not going to do me any good. Well, it's not going to do me any good directly, but the VA is not only for veterans. It's our U.S. It's our only U.S. healthcare system. And the VA teaches 70% of America's doctors in its models of clinical care, teamwork, safety, et cetera. It teaches most 40 other health professions. The VA employs more nurses than any other institution and is the only institution in America that has lift equipment to protect nurses. The VA does research that benefits us all. I mean, I got the shingles vaccine because of VA research. And, you know, anybody out there who has an implantable cardiac pacemaker or the nicotine patch, that's all VA research. It is our VA. It's not just a veterans issue. You know, I mean, obviously, veterans are directly involved, and we have a contract with veterans that we really should fulfill. Because if we start taking, in all-volunteer army, if we start taking this away from veterans, I mean, who's going to serve? And but I think it's you know, the VA has developed models of care that are specific to the problems veterans have. And I have, in the 4 years I've been watching VA care, I've really, really begun to respect that in ways I really didn't recognize before, that these veterans have very specific problems. I mean, they go into the military at age, you know, 18, before their brains are fully formed. They get re-socialized. Many of them are in danger, and then they come out and they have a lot of problems with adjustment, et cetera, et cetera. And we have to give them care that is veteran specific. And we have a healthcare system that has developed that kind of expertise over 70 years. And we as a country have invested in that. I have invested in that since I started paying taxes. So it is my healthcare system.
Joining us now is Lou Kern. And Lou, I want to thank you for being with us today, along with me and Suzanne Gordon, the author of The Battle for Veterans Healthcare. Tell our listeners a little bit about your own experience with the VA and how they addressed your needs.
Well, I, like many veterans, wasn't even aware that I could use the VA healthcare system for many years. And I finally went probably 20 years ago now. So I'm a Vietnam veteran, so I just turned 70, in fact. Mm-hmm. So I'm in that age group. And, you know, the way I like to express it is I ran a small business for 40 years. And when you do that, your checkbook's on the on the floor out there in the shop. And you're responsible for everything. And you get a sense. You walk in a place and you get a sense right away of, you know, do the people really care what they're doing? You know, that kind of thing. Are they efficient? Is there movement? How are they moving? How are they reacting to one another? And so when I first went to the VA, I was very happily startled. It looked like a whole bunch of people weren't working for me.
So you looked around and you thought the shop was orderly and the people were invested, right?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they cared. You know, they cared. You could tell.
And so I take it that you didn't use the VHA for some period of time, and then issues arose that caused you to seek treatment?
Well, yes. I wasn't aware. I could have used it starting right after the war. I wasn't even aware that it was available to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I became aware that it was available to me, it was paid for by the government, as opposed to me, you know, paying hundreds of dollars every month for health care. I switched over.
Mm-hmm. And so did you find that the health care was as good as or even better than what you found in the private sector?
I did. And I would frequently go in with my wife, who's a nurse, and she works in the private sector. And, it's like having an advocate when you go in, you know, if you have a nurse with you. And she was impressed, too. She said, this is a well-run organization. And so I've been very happy with the health care that I've gotten.
Mm-hmm.
And,
All right. And let me ask you what you think about the prospects of privatizing part or all of the Veterans Health Care Administration.
Well, you know, I thought a lot about that because there's an anti-government movement, a whole narrative out there that the government can't do anything right and private industry somehow has some magic. And if you turn things over to private industry, they end up better off. And I don't believe that's true. I think that there are some things the government does very well. And, we have the best military in the world, and that's run by the government. You know, our Social Security system runs very efficiently, and it's run by the government. So I don't... from what I see at the VA and from what I read in independent surveys, and I think the importance of that is, you know, I'm here in San Francisco and the Oakland, you know, Bay Area. Well, I don't know what the VA hospital is like in Louisiana, but independent surveys that have gone around and checked on all this stuff come back and say, this is a really good healthcare system. And I believe those surveys as well as my own experience here locally.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Lou, is there anything else you'd like to add? I appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, no, thanks. I would, it's just a great life, Peter. You know, it's great to go in and feel taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And, rather than to be, you know, a cog in a profit wheel.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's the best way to say it. You know, for-profit healthcare is... You see it, you know. You go in and the doctor has 10 minutes to spend with you. And it doesn't matter if you come in with a list of 10 things because you've been waiting 2 months to see your primary and you've got a list of 10 things, and you're lucky to get through half of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, of course, that list gets bigger as you get older.
Well,
and,
these days...
With the VA, I don't feel rushed. I don't feel like I'm being pushed on to whatever the next thing is.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you for your comments, Lou. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Right.
So,
bye.
Suzanne, Dr. David Shulkin has been named as the director of the cabinet-level agency, the Veterans Administration, and he came from inside, and he is very different from almost all of the appointees. He's not a millionaire or billionaire. He is not devoted to wrecking the institution that he's been put in charge of. There have been some nice bio pieces that I've read about him, that he continues to see patients, some by video, remote. And so it seems like for the first time in a while, we actually have somebody running the VA who is experienced in its mission and committed to it.
Well, I think we've had a number of undersecretaries of health. Dr. Shukin was undersecretary for health, and he came out of the private sector, so he has a very limited experience with the VA.
Oh, I thought he was there for a while. That's my mistake.
He was there. He came when Bob McDonald took over as VA secretary, and
and McDonald was the Procter and Gamble executive,
right?
And how did he do in your book?
Well, in my book, I think he tried to defend the VA, but he was working for President Obama for Democrats, I think Dr. Shulkin, I think David Shulkin understands the VA and understands the special nature of the VA. I think the tragedy is that he is working for a president and a Republican Congress that is promoting privatization. And I think that he is being pressured to send more patients out into the private sector. And I think that if he were working for a different administration, he would take very different positions. President Trump is giving a marginal increase in his budget to the VA and secretaries of the VA. And if you work for the president, you're supposed to go along with the budget projections. And so the budget is not big enough. One of the things that Dr. Shulkin is doing that is wonderful is focusing on suicide prevention and on increasing the access to VA mental health care of veterans who have what's called other than honorable discharges, which is a discharge categorization that denies them VHA benefits, even though they got into trouble in the Army, perhaps, in the military because of mental health problems, acting out because of mental health problems, and they need mental health services, but they aren't allowed to get them. And the secretary is proposing giving those people 90 days of emergency mental health care, but there's no funding for it. And so I think that we need to look at the issue of funding. And you have also a lot of pressure on VA secretaries by Congress and the media to punish employees, to blame employees for every social problem, to blame VA employees. The Congress has just passed a very punitive accountability measure that, in the guise of accountability, takes away workplace rights.
And the New York Times article says that President Trump is promoting whistleblowers. Only at the VA.
Right. Well, I know. That's hilarious. I mean, it's really quite hilarious. And, you know, in healthcare, I mean, one of the things that they're attacking is union bargaining rights and due process. And they used to say that in order to fire or discipline somebody, you had to have a preponderance of evidence. And now you only need a mere scintilla. Hmm. Well, this is very frightening. And it's like, you know, going back to Tammany Hall, because you really want people in healthcare systems to speak up, because if a nurse tells a doctor he's giving the wrong drug and the doctor says to the nurse, you know, come back and talk to me when you've gone through medical school, and blows her off, if she now fears that that physician or manager of that unit will, only needing a scintilla of evidence, fire her or discipline her for insubordination, she is not going to speak up, nor is the housekeeper, nor is anybody who's saying, well, choice doesn't work or whatever. So these are very punitive actions that we need. And leadership, you know, Congress, the Republican version of leadership in Congress is punish, 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 build walls, keep people out, and so forth. And we know in patient safety that real patient leadership in a healthcare system is support, 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 and obviously discipline and fire if you need to, if people are reckless. But this is not the standard that is being employed. And you don't want whistleblowers in a healthcare system. You want problem solvers. If you don't have an environment where you can have problem solvers, then, of course, you create whistleblowers. But what they're creating is an environment that says you cannot be a problem solver or you risk being fired. So the only option is to be a whistleblower. And that is that does not encourage employee engagement, and it doesn't encourage safety. safety.
Mm-hmm. In your book, The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, you devote quite a bit of attention to the commission that was created by this act of Congress in 2014. It's called a Commission on Care, and you point out very politely that it is stacked with people who are pro-privatization. And you also feature an interview with one of the commissioners who is opposed. That's Philip Longman, senior editor of the Washington Monthly. Just thumbnail for our listeners where this commission has gone so far and the extent to which they are a stalking horse for privatization.
So the Commission on Care disbanded in 2016 with a report suggesting a whole bunch of things, one of which is the creation of an integrated care network. I agree and disagree with that proposal. Philip Longman, who wrote a book called Best Care Anywhere about the VA, was a commissioner who really staunchly opposed privatization. Michael Blecker of San Francisco Swords to Plowshares, executive director, who is a veteran himself.
Great guy.
Who's a wonderful man. And he actually dissented from the commission's report because of this idea of an integrated care network. We are going to see more about that in the coming weeks and months. And I think that the VA leadership under David Shulkin is promoting this notion of putting a lot of energy into creating more choice for veterans. I think that it's important to have private sector health care available to veterans when necessary, when the VA can't provide the services, but only when they can't. And I really oppose ideas that have been floated by VA leadership that, for example, you get rid of audiology and optometry because there's a lens crafter on every corner. And the VA does an excellent job on this. And when a veteran goes in with a hearing problem or an eye problem or low vision, and the VA, by the way, has comprehensive hearing care and a whole system of blind rehabilitation hospitals that are, I mean, blind rehabilitation programs that are inpatient programs that are second to none and simply unavailable in the private sector. And the thing is that these people work in the same hospital. I mean, an audiologist and an optometrist has to learn about recognizing the signs of suicidality. So if a veteran goes to the hearing specialist and they have an appointment in 2 weeks and the veteran says, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to make it. You know, I may not be here. I may not be around that long. The hearing specialist is going to say, whoopsie, and call, you know, put a flag in, call somebody. That's not going to happen in the private sector. Yeah. And so.
Well, and this parallels what's going on in education with Betsy DeVos promoting, again, the word choice comes into play, but charter schools clearly siphon off the tax revenues and hurt public education. While they pretend that it doesn't damage the existing public schools and it just provides parents with additional options. But these are very dangerous programs that do bleed the predecessor and open up the opportunity for opportunists to dive in and push for privatization.
Absolutely. And what they end up doing is they starve the public sector of needed resources and staff. People at the VA, I know these caregivers. I am so impressed with their devotion. I mean, I have met people who should not be employed in healthcare in the VA as I have in the private sector. But I am really impressed by the devotion of the and the mission-drivenness of these employees of at every level. And by the way, 100,000 of them, of the 300,000 plus that work for the VA are veterans themselves. And this constant bashing, I mean, I do not believe that the VA is in critical condition. A patient in critical condition is by definition, you know, highly unstable and is about to die and maybe they'll live. You know, most patients who are on ICUs actually don't make it. And the VA is, you know, by every measure is a very healthy healthcare system. What they're doing is creating a crisis and they're making it uncomfortable. Right now, there's a move in Congress to deny federal to increase the pension contributions by something like $2,500 a month, $2,500 a year of VA of federal employees, which again is another thing. So here you have
just like the post office,
right? Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have the VA is not allowed to offer market rate salaries to employees. Now you're going to increase the pension contributions. You're bashing them in the media. Sometimes the leadership, the leadership in Congress, which is their board of directors and CEO, et cetera, is bashing them. I mean, we have to make the VA attractive. And it is attractive. It's a wonderful healthcare system. And I believe we should have VA for all, not Medicare for all, you know?
I would like that. Well, Suzanne, thank you for joining us today. The new book is The Battle for Veterans Healthcare, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Policymaking and Patient Care. Suzanne maintains a website at suzannegordon.com. And where's the best place for people to buy your book?
Either Cornell University Press or Amazon, or it is in some bookstores, but it's primarily on Amazon. And I would love it if people would go to my website. There's also the website of the Fighting for Veterans Healthcare, FFVHC.org, and other groups like Vote Vets and the Disabled American Veterans. And mm-hmm. we need to get people to join the fight.
Thank you, and thank you for your passion.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview. I welcome your comments and feedback, especially if you're a veteran. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.